Hello, this is Susan Smith Nash, and you are listening to a few e-learning ruminations at the behest of the e-learning queen. She is quite the tyrannical sort, and I'm quite the obedient minion. So here it goes. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the idea of how instructional designers are caught in a difficult situation being everything to everyone. Okay, so you can't be everything to everyone, and yet instructional designers are forced to be just that. Instructional design and its big sister, instructional psychology, have gone through major sea changes in the last few years as technology, neuroscience, learning environment variations, and the need for access and inclusiveness have broadened the field to the point that some have claimed it has lost its focus and has become completely unmanageable. I don't know what you think about that. I think there are some points to it. At any rate, I was talking to Brinder, an instructional designer, and she said, "You know, it's either chaos or cookie cutter." I didn't really know what she meant, but I thought about it. She had worked for a long time developing training manuals and also computer-based programs for military applications. As an instructional designer, she decided to branch out, so she was now focusing on asynchronous learning either through online, CD-ROM, or PDA delivery modes. So she was continuing on. She said, "If you talk with people in the different departments, you'll see exactly what goes on," she said. "Yeah, sure, there may be a lot of progress, shared resources, improved learning management systems, software, etc., templates, even useful templates. But people between departments still waste a lot of time competing with each other or fighting with each other when they could be building a team. What they don't realize is that they are wasting energy, while the world outside, that is, the competition, is starting to leave them in the dust." So I thought about it, and I thought, what is she getting at? And Brinder went on to talk about how innovative learning organizations considered leaders in their field have basically started to go back to the fundamentals. They are publishing guidebooks, they're publishing best practices, they're going through different tests, doing benchmarking, and they freely share them. Athabasca University in Alberta is just one of those institutions. And they, like the others, make their practices for undergraduate courses freely available. So anyway, I asked Brinder, "Well, okay, in your opinion, what actually constitutes effective learning? And what does one need to have in order to have a good learning environment? You know, what are the basics? What are the basic requirements in a good learning environment? And, you know, with that in mind, how do you make the concepts work across platforms, across delivery modes, you know, all varieties of distance, as well as face-to-face and, let's not forget, blended and or hybrid courses?" Well, she didn't exactly answer that question, but then she went on to say, "The problem with guides such as Athabasca's is that some people do not read them carefully. They just take a mechanical approach. They get in a hurry, and they just use the Athabasca model to crunch out courses without even considering how people learn." Brinder went on. She said, You know, in my opinion, the best approach is to take a look at the winners of the benchmarking contests. And let's just see what they're doing. So she went on, she rattled off who the winners of the so-called benchmarking, quality benchmarking for e-learning were. And I have to say, I wasn't too surprised when I heard the top six. But at the same time, there were a few that gave me reason for a little pause. Number one was, not surprisingly, Athabasca University, Athabasca, Alberta, Canada. And the second one surprised me. It made me want to go on a field trip and visit them. It was School of New Resources. It was the College of New Rochelle in the Bronx, New York. Wow, that is really amazing. The third was the School for New Learning, DePaul University, Chicago, Illinois. And then I thought that was kind of encouraging. You know, I think that they're a Jesuit, correct? But I thought, well, you know, as a mission-driven institution, it's really heartening to see those institutions that have a very, very firm, long-lived, focused vision be considered leaders in their field in terms of online learning and quality. Number four, Empire State College, part of the SUNY system. It's in Saratoga Springs, New York. Number five, and this one is another one that kind of surprised me, Merrillhurst University in Merrillhurst, Oregon. I have to say, I'm not even familiar with them, so I'm encouraged. I'm going to contact them right away and find out what they're up to. And then number six, Sinclair Community College, Dayton, Ohio. Now, that one surprised me too. I would have thought somebody like Coastline Community College in California would have been hands down the leader of the pack in terms of community colleges, because they're so innovative and they have so many resources. But I don't know. I'll have to look at the criteria. So I talked to Brenda again. I said, well, you know, what's going on? And she said, well, okay, it's interesting to look at the winners. Everybody likes to see the people at the top of their game. But, she said, I think you learn more by the people who are in trouble. It's very interesting to look at schools in trouble, she said. And not just to, like, morbidly be fascinated in this, like, voyeuristic way, being fascinated by the, you know, in this ghoulish way in their, with their trouble. No, it's not Schadenfreude, unhinged. It's something else. It has to do with analyzing what on earth they did wrong. I mean, what is the primordial basis of this tragedy, going from top of their game to sort of imminent demise? Anyway, Brenda went on to point out that many times schools fall down because they become distracted. I said, well, what are they distracted by? She said, well, they're distracted by the seemingly infinite array of A, delivery options, B, markets, C, technological advances, and they lose sight of the basics, and they lose the sight of the fact that these things need to be applied to all delivery modes, and they need to be considered in all learning environments, and learner attributes, applied to learner attributes. So she went through and listed out the fundamental issues in terms of getting back to basics. So number one, focused goals. She said you have to understand the goals of a course and a program. It's more important than ever. However, there's a caveat. Learning objectives and outcomes must not be too rigidly tied to one delivery mode. They have to remain conceptual. They have to be applicable to all situations and all settings. And she said, okay, this requires clear focus. You have to connect content, instructional activities, and outcomes to the work the course instructor, facilitator, or professor is working with. You have to have goals that are focused, but they're focused enough to provide guidance to the instructor. We forget, you know, we need to guide the instructor. We assume the instructor is just all-knowing, sage on the stage. But in the e-learning environment, that's a different situation. We have to be flexible, can't be rigid. The faculty member has to be able to adjust the approach in order to meet individual learner needs. Okay, number two, challenging tasks. Engaged learners require tasks that stimulate them to think, problem solve, make connections. She went on to say, tasks that stimulate result in informal communities of practice among former learners must be encouraged. They have to be focused towards self-directed research and writing. Brenda went on to explain that tasks must be both relevant and helpful to stimulate and the needs of students. Affiliation and achievement should be considered in developing all tasks. Third item, clear assessment and evaluation standards. Brenda said, well, this is, like other guidelines, sort of self-evident, or it may seem so, but in point of fact, it's really a place where distance and flexible learning is like at its most ambiguous. So as a result, this is probably the place where learners are most frustrated. And again, that's assessment and evaluation. Brenda said that successful programs set out the expectations clearly, and they set them out at the outset, so that way students have a chance to ask questions, and they have a chance to ask for productive clarification and or feedback. Now, people can become a little bit over the top with assessments, said Brenda, and she said, okay, remember, they should be appropriate for the learner's environment so that learners have a choice of assessment methods, so that individual needs are met and accommodations are made for physical and logistical challenges. Here's another issue, protection from adverse consequences for initial failures. So Brenda, I thought, was like really wise with this one. She said, nothing discourages like failure. Well, okay, this is a little tongue-in-cheek. I have to say, I thought, well, yes. Tell us something we didn't know. But she said, okay, nothing discourages like failure. Okay, particularly when the environment feels punitive rather than encouraging. Instead of failure, the environment must be configured so that learners and faculty are encouraged to experiment, and they should be rewarded for continuing to try, even if initial attempts are fruitless. There should be affirmation of performance. So I said, well, Brenda, what is affirmation of performance? She said, positive reinforcement for learner activities while engaged in a course must take place. I said, okay. But here's the thing. In an online environment, reinforcement isn't the same as good job, or here's your Scooby treat, here's your Scooby snack, Scooby-Doo, Scooby-Dooby-Doo. my generation is showing high. But anyway, so like, positive reinforcement is not just from like a 1970s Saturday morning cartoon. It has to come from numerous sources which are online. So it can come from the instructor, it can come from other learners, but it can also come from the interface itself. If the interface has stuff like games or interactivity, like little things that are self-tasks that reward the learner for having successfully completed something. So there are some like built-in intrinsic rewards. So anyway, Brinder said, I don't want to go into like all these details with intrinsic motivation or different motivation theories, but just suffice it to say that those are important. Affiliation with others. Brinder explained that in distant environments, the more that affiliation emulates true human contact, the better. And she explained that this usually takes place in the form of text-based email exchanges and instant message, or chat, or discussion boards. But this is changing, and audio, instant messaging, and movie clips are becoming more feasible, as smart cell phones, PDAs, and other portable devices make such communications small in terms of size, flexible in terms of medium, portable, anytime, any place, and possible. And, okay, we get distracted by the toys, right? We're playing with the toys. But Brinder said, don't look at the toy. Remember, the toy is the tool. The toy is the tool to help get us to those affiliation needs. So affiliation must be made possible by the tool, the toy, and by the superstructure of an institution that assures a safe environment for the exchange of ideas. And this is another critical thing, respect for individual difference. Brinder went on to say a few more things. Okay, she said, novelty and variety. Boredom kills motivation. Individuals have come to expect stimulating, challenging, changing, and relevant environments. They should be graphic rich, and they offer individualized, personalized experiences, and they also have the services they need at a touch. Now, okay, this has always been the case, but as she pointed out, recent developments in technology have made this all the more true for courses offered via technology. Now, while consistency is important in classes because it helps students overcome so-called ambiguity anxiety, too much consistency results in boredom. So there she said, okay, cookie cutter, cookie cutter, cookie cutter. For Brinder, that's a bad thing. Courses must be constantly reviewed, not just by subject matter experts or designers, but by the actual users. Brinder said, okay, another issue, choice. Learners need to have a chance to choose. This does not apply simply to institutions nor simply to courses, but also to learning activities within the course. If the courses are flexible, students will be able to tailor the courses to meet their individual needs. Effective learning environments accommodate individual difference, says. Authenticity. This is Brinder's final point on her list of must-have pieces. Authenticity. I go, authenticity? Well, yeah, aren't we, like, authentic? I'm an authentic person. She looked at me and said, no, you're not. Okay, I'm not getting into this. Let's just explain. Please help me understand how this works in the online environment. According to Brinder and other instructional technologists and psychologists, authenticity has to do with the integrity of the human experience. Authenticity is highly valued in all environments, but according to Brinder, it's very, very important in a distance environment. Why? It's because the connections to learner needs, goals, and experience are absolutely vital, as are connections to real-life conditions, scenarios, people, places, and case studies. So, authenticity matters. So, I just want to thank you for listening to this overview. I want to say that it has been fairly simplistic. It's kind of a view of how instructional designers continue to maintain focus on the basics. But it's also something else. I mean, if you go to the website, you'll also see this fabulous list of resources. In other words, a long kind of list of bibliographical resources, works cited, etc. So that's the end of today's fruitful rumination by a trusty minion of the very demanding e-learning queen. And the e-learning queen is a little bit testy today because she realized that a version of this that you've just heard was published in Explanazine, which is okay. You know, it was cool. That was what was expected. I mean, it was submitted. It was reviewed. It was accepted by their editor and editorial board. But this is what has the e-learning queen a little bit peeved, torqued, whatever. It was published under the wrong name. How on earth did that happen? So, I'm sure that it has been corrected by the time that you listen to this. But if not, please believe me, the e-learning queen is the person, the thing, the entity who commanded her minion, me, Susan Smith Nash, to write this thing and also to describe it to you as I'm talking to you in this like wonderfully intimate setting. So, this has gotten to be sort of long. We're at 22 minutes. I'm going to bid a good farewell to you. Fare thee well, and I will talk to you soon. Ciao. Ciao, amore. Bye.